vaccines are not safe, they don't keep you from getting sick, and they definitely do cause harm. So I'm an osteopathic physician, and that means as an American-trained osteopath, which is different than osteopaths in England or Australia or other parts of the world. An American-trained osteopath has all the credentials, all the training as an MD allopathic medical doctor. So I have done all of the allopathic things in my life. I was the director of an emergency department for 12 years, a level 2 trauma center. And what makes an American-trained osteopath different is that we can do anything that an MD can do, meaning we can be a neurosurgeon or an ER doc or an obstetrician or any subspecialty. But we're also trained in osteopathic manual medicine, similar to, but in my opinion, a little bit better than a chiropractor, because we have lots of different manual medicine tools in our toolbox. So I always look at osteopaths, American-trained osteopaths, as like allopathic MDs on steroids, because we can do a whole bunch of more things than they are trained to do. In September of 2000, I attended the National Vaccine Information Center meeting in Washington, D.C., and I sat through 4 days of meetings, listened to doctors, researchers, scientists, parents of vaccine-injured children, parents of unvaccinated children, and I thought, how did I miss this whole concept of vaccine injury? You know, I've been in medicine by 15 years by then. I've had my own clinic for 5 years. How did I miss this? Maybe I better investigate this a little bit more. So I came home from that meeting and started looking at the documents from the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC documents, and I couldn't believe what I was reading, that it was like, these are poorly written and they really don't say much, and every reference is the CDC. So it's like, if Dr. Tenpenny wrote an article and every reference was Dr. Tenpenny's articles, it would seem kind of bizarre to me. And so I started digging deeper, and that digging deeper has turned into a 20-year investigation with more than 40,000 hours of digging through only peer-reviewed literature or published literature from the government, from the CDC or the NIH or places like or the FDA. And what I've actually found is that vaccines are not safe. They don't keep you from getting sick, and they definitely do cause harm. And that 40,000 hours of research is a real number. I mean, I've gone back and like looked at that specifically. And so I've spent a lot of years investigating the problems associated with vaccines. So I feel like the things that I say come from a studied opinion. They're not just something that I make up off the top of my head. I've spent 40,000 hours and almost 20 years. In September, it'll be 20 years. And I've never wavered from my message, Michael. I've always said that vaccines are not safe. They do not keep you from getting sick. They definitely cause harm. They're definitely unnecessary. And this entire industry is built on propaganda and multi-generational indoctrination into a myth. And the whole industry, in my opinion, just needs to stop and go away. Primarily when I started drilling down on the ingredients, and I started noticing that all the toxic chemicals that were in vaccines, including several known carcinogens, the mercury that's inside of the thimerosal, the nearly 12,000 micrograms of aluminum that is injected into a fully vaccinated child from birth, and if you receive every vaccine from birth until 18 years of age, it's almost 12,000 micrograms of aluminum, and that goes into the muscle, gets picked up by the white blood cells, and can get transmitted across the blood-brain barrier into the brain. It was really the ingredients that I noted first. The second thing that really opened my eyes was the fact that up through 1985, there were only three vaccines in the pediatric schedule. There was MMR, polio, and DPT. And it wasn't until 1991 when they started ramping up the schedule till now that children get multiple doses of 16 or 17 vaccines, depending on how you count them. And so the pure amount of toxic ingredients that are getting injected into small children, and also adolescents and adults, and then the multiple number of vaccines that children get. I mean, I really believe that if you just got one vaccine once in a while, probably the volume of distribution of that one cc of what's coming through that needle in a larger body, if the child was, you know, 2 years old or 4 years old or 10 or 20 years old as an adult, that probably that one cc would have a lesser toxic effect. Vaccines have never been tested for carcinogenicity, means their ability to cause cancer, teratogenicity, which means their ability to cause birth defects, or whether or not they can cause infertility later on in life because of all the toxic ingredients. So it's all that taken together, and you think about that we've got the most unhealthy generation of human beings ever, that it's just time to stop. it's time to stop this multi-generational indoctrination with propaganda based on myths that have no basis in reality. Boron, which technically is a metal, and it comes in the form of sodium borax, and that's found in some of the hepatitis A vaccines and in the Gardasil vaccine. But that's not strictly a metal in the way that we think of aluminum or aluminium, as you guys say. But it's certainly, there's more of it. When they decided to take the mercury, the thimerosal, out of vaccines in 2004, that's when they started loading in the aluminum. And it's pretty interesting because mercury was initially put into the vaccines to be an astringent. It's supposed to kill the bacteria and any stray viruses that might be in the final solution, but it doesn't do a good job of that at all. It's supposed to keep it as a preservative. And aluminum is really an adjuvant, so that even though they're both metals, and as they took out the mercury, they put in aluminum, each of them act by a different mechanism of action. It definitely causes oxidative stress because it's a toxic substance that doesn't belong in the blood. So by definition, that's going to create an oxidative stress to try to remove it from the blood, increasing certain cytokines that cause inflammation. There's a long list of ingredients in vaccines. And in fact, I believe there's close to 200 different chemicals that are in vaccines. Now, that doesn't mean one vaccine has 200 chemicals, but if you get doses of all the existing vaccines, you will get doses of those chemicals. And there's things like polysorbate 80, which is actually a flow agent. So when you make the vaccine in a big vat and then you flow it through tubules to end up to put it into the little vials, it helps to keep all of those ingredients that are in there, the proteins and the viruses and the chemicals, it keeps them from clumping together. Polysorbate 80 is also a food grade ingredient, and it ends up in things like cans of frosting and just really things that don't belong in your blood, right? The other thing that polysorbate 80 does, it has the ability to punch holes in the blood-brain barrier and allow anything in that's in the neighborhood, so to speak. They've actually made chemotherapeutic drugs attached to polysorbate 80, the ones that address brain cancers, because it's very difficult to get a drug across the blood-brain barrier into the brain. And when you have a brain tumor or a brain cancer, they have to actually combine polysorbate 80 to that particular drug in order for it to carry across the blood-brain barrier to attack brain tumors and brain cancers. So we know for sure that that chemical has the ability to do that because they actually work with it to make it do that. And so we know that if polysorbate 80 is in with a vaccine and it has aluminum and other types of ingredients, it's going to open the blood-brain barrier and allow those to go in. There's also something called beta-propylactone, which is a known carcinogen. We know that it's on all the different lists of government toxic chemicals like OSHA and things like that, that listed as a known carcinogen. Now, some people will say that the body makes formaldehyde, and so how can formaldehyde in the vaccines cause any problems? Well, the body makes carbon compounds that look similar to the formulation of what the chemical combination and the compound of formaldehyde looks like, but it's very different when that's happening on the inside and it's degrading quickly as opposed to a large dose that's actually injected into your muscle. Because we know that formaldehyde, if you breathe it in, it can cause horrible reactions inside of your nose and can cause cancer in your throat. We know that if it gets into your eyes, it can cause all kinds of problems, including blindness. So how can we possibly think that injecting milligram amounts of formaldehyde into a muscle of a little baby is a benign process? So we actually have one of our educational platforms. It's called VaccineU, vaccinetheletteru.com, and we offer a 7-part course called Problematic Ingredients. So if people want to drill down on the specifics of each of these different chemicals that are in vaccines, they can go and look at our courses inside of VaccineU. And there's a course on all of the different adjuvants. There's a specific course on aluminum, one on mercury, one on foreign proteins, and one on the foreign cells that are inside of the vaccines, like the cells from aborted fetal tissue. And so there's places where people can go and take a really deep dive into that if they're interested in knowing what's really coming through that needle. It's the economic loss leader of the entire medical industrial complex industry. I truly believe that every single vaccine can cause damage, every single shot. causes injury at some level, either at the cellular level down into the mitochondria that disrupts things at the mitochondrial level, which can cause fatigue and autoimmune conditions, or at a macroscopic level where people can have seizure disorders, autoimmune diseases, horrible eczema. Every vaccine causes some level of damage to the body, even if it's just a matter of just shaving off a few IQ points with each vaccine that they get, so that the child's brain just doesn't work exactly right. And so it's the economic loss leader of the industry. As soon as a child gets a vaccine or an adult gets a vaccine and they start to develop symptoms, they go to the doctor. When they go to the doctor, what happens next? They get a bunch of tests. They get blood tests, x-rays, high-end sorts of tests from the super subspecialists. And each of those things cost a lot of money. The tests cost money. The doctor's fees cost money. You go to the subspecialist and the super subspecialist, and when they can't find anything overtly wrong with you, or they can label you with something like lupus or some sort of, you know, bizarre autoimmune disease, and then they can give you a label, and then they can diagnose you, and they can get they can bill insurance for that. And then you become a customer for life of the pharmaceutical industry, because now we've got a $1 trillion book of business out there of all these different drugs that we can give you to suppress your symptoms. So now you've become a customer for life of the pharmaceutical industry. So the first agenda, in my opinion, is that vaccines cause damage that drive the pump as the economic loss leader, because they give away vaccines for free. They come to your place of business. You can get them at a public health department. You know, you can get them anywhere basically for free or for a nominal amount of charge. And they're willing to give that away to draw you in to be a customer for life of the entire pharmaceutical industry. So that's the first agenda. I mean, that's the main thing. It's money and a customer for life. I really believe that there's a big depopulation agenda that comes along with vaccines. And for all of us that have talked about vaccine safety and informed consent for all of these years, I mean, it really does. We've kind of stayed away from the whole idea of eugenics and the depopulation agenda, because it's really hard to take someone who's new to this topic and has a 200-year multi-generational indoctrination in the belief of vaccines. It's actually a faith. It's like a religion. And it's hard to take them from that place of, I trust that human being with that white coat standing in front of me, and I believe in vaccines, and I believe that they are necessary, to take them to the point of saying, you know, vaccines are not good and you really shouldn't do it. That's a pretty big leap. To take them to the next belief, to make them understand that this is truly a weapon of mass destruction, and it's a biological warfare against humanity, and it's truly one of the most dangerous things that we've ever done to human beings, and it's the biggest scam ever propagated on the human race, and that there really is a eugenics depopulation agenda there. That is such a big leap psychologically for people that they just really, really label us as tinfoil hat conspiracy theorists if we get to that point. But the truth of the matter is that's the truth. And that you, once you see the whole big agenda, and now with everything that's coming down with Bill Gates, and he's even said, you know, we've got the vaccines, if they do their job, we'll decrease the population by at least 10%. And to know that Bill Gates' dad was one of the original funders of Planned Parenthood and one of the original funders of the American eugenicist movement. I mean, it's time for us to be talking about this. And I feel really strongly about that, because time is short. We've got about 6 months, in my opinion, and those of us that have been doing a lot of interviews and talking about this, to really wake up the world to stand up to this tyranny, this medical tyranny that's upon us, and before we just don't have any choices left. And I think informed consent is like an old term that doesn't mean anything anymore. It was a great thing to talk about through the 2000s and even maybe from 2010 to 2020, that people needed to be informed about vaccines and they needed to be really informed about the good and the bad. And then they could give their consent and either choose to be vaccinated anyways because they were so terrified of whatever infection they were trying to prevent, or not. But now that we're talking about mandatory vaccination and mandatory microchipping and contact tracers and people downloading apps on your phone to follow you everywhere, which is a really nice way to say spying on you. You know, to call it contact tracers is a nice new word for spying on you and snitching on your neighbor. which didn't we do that in Nazi Germany? Didn't we train like the Nazi youth corps to go and spy on their parents? Aren't we kind of repeating history here? So we need to talk about that. We need to wake people up because they are in such a deep coma by all the propaganda and all the Kool-Aid they've been drinking of this propaganda for so many years, that the only way that we have a chance of doing anything different here is really coming on very strong. Not everybody's going to wake up to this, but the people that do are going to need a strong message of waking up to stand up against this medical tyranny and this tyranny and this propaganda that they've been feeding us for all these years. So the three things are the economic loss leaders to the industry. Number two is making you a customer for life of the pharmaceutical industry. And the third is the depopulation agenda. I mean, and that's why when we try to talk about health, what you can do to stay healthy without being vaccinated, why that's either not repeated or it's suppressed because it doesn't go along with the agenda. It doesn't go along with that agenda of feeding the beast, feeding it money. It's all about injecting you for commerce and about controlling you. And if we can't do either one of those, then maybe one of those nifty little vaccines that we want to mandatorily make you have just might kill you. The closest thing that we have to sort of accumulating statistics on vaccine injury is in America, the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, which is a place where people can report an adverse event. It has been estimated that somewhere between only 1 and 10% of all vaccine injuries are actually reported to VAERS, the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, because people don't recognize that it's an adverse event. I mean, unless you have an immediate type reaction, like as soon as you have the shot, you develop a seizure disorder, or you get anaphylactic shock, or you end up with hives, or you end up with you can't breathe, like immediately. There's an immediate type reaction. People often don't connect the dots between the vaccine and the illness that they develop anywhere from 2, 4, 6 months later or a couple of years later. So, and it's hard to prove it. And the FDA and the pharmaceutical industry has set that up intentionally. I mean, if you haven't had a reaction within 48 hours and it comes later, well, it wasn't the vaccine. You were just going to have a reaction anyways, you know, so you have a faulty body that could not handle the onslaught of all those chemicals that we injected in you. And it was going to happen anyways. It had nothing to do with the vaccine. And that's where they come up with this phrase of temporal association does not prove causality, which means that if you have a vaccine today and 2 weeks later you develop some sort of health condition, that doesn't prove anything that the vaccine caused it. It's just that you were a defective person and you were going to develop this autoimmune or neurological problem anyways. The coronavirus, this new vaccine that they're trying to develop for this particular virus, which is a whole family of viruses. The coronavirus family has 36 known viruses in it that have been around for 60 years, six decades. And there are four of those viruses that cause up to 40% of influenza-like illness globally every single winter. So these viruses have been around for a really, really, really long time. And they've been, and because of the, what they would call the burden of injury or the burden of illness, meaning that it causes people, a lot of people to get flu-like symptoms every year, they've been trying to develop a coronavirus vaccine for 20 years or more. They've never been able to bring it to market because of the deleterious effects that that vaccine causes in humans. And when they, because what they're trying to do is to take a little bit of the viral RNA, which is the genetics part of the virus, and inject it into human beings. And then humans use their own enzymes called reverse transcriptase to replicate that virus. So as you get more and more of the virus inside of your body, and then your body develops an antibody to that foreign protein to try to neutralize it. So and as they try to neutralize it with this particular virus, it creates the wrong type of antibody. It creates an antibody that causes an accelerated autoimmune condition. So when you're re-exposed to that coronavirus again, the animals to die. They have an adverse effect to that. So when you get the vaccine would go into experimental animals. It would start to replicate. It would have what researchers called a a robust immune response, which means the body, the animal said, wow, look at this foreign protein. We need to create a lot of antibody to get it out of here. So when they measured the bloodstream and they have a really high amount of antibody, they said this is a very robust immune response. That's a good thing with what the researchers want. Then they say, okay, let's see if that high level, let me get the right word here for you, if that high level of antibody really does what it's intended to do, if it really does what it's intended to do, and protect that animal from contracting coronavirus infection. So now they re-expose that animal to the coronavirus they're trying to protect against. And because that antibody that was created was something called a paradoxical immune enhancement, so it created, instead of an antibody that neutralizes the virus and might protect you from getting sick, it created an antibody that poked holes in a lot of your individual cells. So when you re-expose that animal to that virus, to the coronavirus would get inside the cells and make the animals horribly sick with an accelerated autoimmune disease, or the animals would actually die. And one of the more recent studies that I read about that was from 2012, which is pretty recent science. And they said at the conclusion of that study said, we must be very, very careful when developing a coronavirus vaccine for human beings because of the types of paradoxical immune response that we see in these experimental animals, that the animals get sick and die. And so the whole process of, is the virus the vaccine for coronaviruses, kind of, because we use reverse transcriptase enzymes inside of our body to replicate the virus and make a lot of it. And I mean, even Bill Gates said, yes, you become your own vaccine factory, except we make the wrong kind of product, so to speak, in terms of antibodies. It not only does it not protect you, it makes you horribly sick and you may even die. It's been the fight between Bouchamp and Pasteur since the 1800s, right? It's been the consummate battle. You know, is it the bug? Is it the pathogen? Or is it the terrain? And it's the health of the terrain. I mean, I've said for many, many decades, you know, health is an inside out process. You know, you're healthy on the inside. You know, we swim in bugs every single day, every day. I mean, our body carries around trillions of them, you know, and if you pet your dog or your cat, or if you have farm animals and you go out in the farm and you milk the cow or you brush your horse, I mean, you're being exposed to these pathogens all the time. And if you've got a healthy terrain and you're healthy from the inside out, it's a big so what. But the only pathogens, the only bugs like what Pasteur talks about that we give pay any attention to are the ones we have a vaccine for. We have a very, very short list of viruses and bacteria that we get our knickers in a knot about. And those are the ones that we have vaccines for. The rest of them, we don't pay any attention to. In fact, I'll tell you a way that you can really prove that premise out really well is if you go to the CDC's website, the Center for Disease Control. You go to their website and you read the section on travel, and they talk about all of the different parasites and viruses and pathogens and different types of things that you might come in contact when you go to a third world foreign country, for which we have no vaccines. We don't have a vaccine for Chagas syndrome, or, you know, for shigellosis or any of those types of pathogens that we might run into in third world countries in dirty water and in the soil and all those things. Well, the CDC has a really good list, it's really quite good, of things that you should do to protect yourself from getting those infections when you're in those third world countries, like wash your hands, boil water, don't drink any drinks that have ice cubes in them that you don't know where the water came from to make the ice cubes, you know, mosquito netting and things like that at night so you don't get malaria, only eat fruits that you can peel. You know, they have a really long, good list of things that you can do to keep from getting infected by those pathogens for which there is no vaccine. Well, if that applies to those, doesn't it also apply to like measles, mumps, rubella, chickenpox, hepatitis A, all the things that we have vaccines for? But no, you can only resist those infections if you're vaccinated. 2 years ago now that they came up with, it was an experimental vaccine for dengue fever, and they trialed it in the Philippines, and it had a similar effect of what we will see if they mandate or bring forward a coronavirus vaccine and they start to mandate it. what the dengue fever had the vaccine had the same response of that paradoxical immune enhancement. So that when the children were re-exposed to the virus that causes dengue fever, thousands of those children died. I think it was up to 6,000 children actually died of that. There were thousands of children died in the Philippines. There was a great outcry in the world, in the Philippines Supreme Court, and in their version, in the local, their local version of, say, their public health departments. They were going to sue the vaccine manufacturer. I think it was Santa Fe Pasteur. You might have to double check that to be sure. But it was one of the vaccine manufacturers. They pulled it from the market. It was a big outcry. It was a really big deal. This was a couple of years ago because of this dengue fever clinical trial that they did in the Philippines. And many, many children were injured or died from that. So it was a big story a couple of years ago. And then, of course, it was buried. All the information was buried, and it really wasn't the vaccine. And maybe a couple of those kids got really injured from the vaccine. All the stuff that they do to bury the information and to make it seem like it was those defective children that were the problem, not the vaccine. Because we really believe that when comes through that needle and gets injected into muscle in human beings, it's like dosing them with injectable holy water. It's really good stuff, and you really should have it. And if it doesn't work right for you, you're the problem, not the vaccine. Because of the plasticity of the human body and the body's ability to heal itself, if you stop throwing toxic material in it, you know, if you stop poisoning it, the body can get better. So imagine that. Imagine that. I mean, what a novel thought, you know, stop injecting foreign matter, cow blood and chicken fibroblasts and cells from aborted fetal tissue and known carcinogens and all those chemicals and metals that we talked about. Stop poisoning people and they can recover. Imagine that. You know, if it wasn't, you know, I'll tell you, the entire industry, the pharmaceutical industry, particularly the vaccine sector, if it wasn't so sinister, it's like the most brilliant business model ever. I mean, they've got these supposedly intelligent, educated people wearing white coats that they call doctors, walking around, writing words on a piece of paper and handing them out for a living, called a prescription. They hand them out, or injecting people with stuff that makes them sick so they can write more words on a piece of paper and hand them out. And the pharmaceutical industry doesn't, none of those doctors are on their payroll, really. They're not, you know, they're not giving them a salary. They're not paying for their holidays. They're not, you know, paying their retirement program. And if they write out the wrong word on a piece of paper and somebody gets a reaction to it, the person who wrote that word on a piece of paper, that prescription, has all the liability for writing the wrong word on the paper. They don't have it, you know, and it's this perpetual motion machine. I give you something, it makes you sick. You go get a test, which we get to pay for the blood test, we get to pay for the x-rays, and we get to pay for more words written on a piece of paper. It's a brilliant business model, if it wasn't so dastardly and absolutely sinister for what it does to human beings. I mean, inside of that vial, and I think that most people, and I believe most physicians believe that's in what's in that little clear liquid vial that they call a vaccine, is the only thing that's in there is a little attenuated or weakened virus or a little piece of bacteria and some sterile water. I mean, I know that that's what I thought forever when I was an ER doc. I didn't know that there was all these other ingredients in vaccines. I thought it was just a little dead virus, attenuated virus, and sterile water. I never bothered to go look it up, and I'm quite sure that most other physicians don't either. So they think that that's all that's in there. What's the big fuss about? We're injecting a little virus in there so you can develop an antibody to it, ostensibly so that if you get re-exposed to that virus, the antibody neutralizes it and you don't get sick, which is the premise of vaccination that is all wrong and all false. None of it's true, what I just said, that they believe. None of that's true. And so you think that what's coming through that needle is just nothing. It's just sterile water. What's the big fuss? Until you start drilling down and knowing what's there. And then you can understand why human beings are being poisoned. They're being systematically poisoned under the umbrella of keeping you healthy and preventing you from getting a fever, a cough, a rash, and some diarrhea, which is what we're really trying to prevent with all this mass hysteria about mass vaccination. I know Dr. Andrew Coffin, and I've had a couple of talks with him, and I've listened to his stuff, and I find it compelling. I find it really very interesting. And when I spoke with him a couple of weeks ago, we've gotten to be friends, and colleagues. And I asked, one of the questions that I asked him was, how long has this information been out there? I mean, how long have we known about this? He said, about 30 years. So in 30 years. So in the big picture of modern medicine, if you want to call it that, that I would say started maybe in the late 1800s, early 1900s, when we started to get medical schools a little bit more standardized and things as we know it. So let's say all the way through the 1900s. So in the last 150 years, 30 years of kind of a new discovery and a new way of thinking about something, that's pretty new science. And there have actually been studies that have shown that when a new concept in healthcare comes to the forefront, for the most part, it takes about 7 years from the bench research and discovery to starting to publish about it, to get it boots on the ground and people to actually start using it is 7 to 10 years. So if this whole concept of the exosome theory that, you know, we have labeled these things called viruses and have entire industries based around that, like, you know, this whole concept of virology and virologists that study all of these things, you know, we have entire huge industries. So this is like a major disruptor to that industry. So does it surprise me that it wasn't like suddenly embraced and everybody go, yeah, look at that? No, because it's going to be an industry disruptor to change people's thoughts about what an exosome really is and how maybe it is a piece of genetic material that we're trying to detox and get out of the system. So I haven't personally taken a real deep dive into that literature yet. I plan to, because I think it's a really compelling way, new piece of information that we need to look at. In the immune system, there's two arms of the immune system, and the names of those arms are TH1 and TH2. And TH1 is your innate immune system that you were born with. And so this whole concept that they say that babies are born without an immune system is just another lie. It wasn't like, you know, babies were born and God went, ah, I forgot the immune system. Please vaccinate. Hurry, hurry, hurry. Vaccinate. Start at day one of birth. I forgot. So babies are born with an innate immune system on the it's called the TH1 pathway, and it's your white blood cells, your macrophages, all these things that are looking around trying to distinguish between self, which is the stuff that's supposed to be here, and non-self, which is foreign that we need to get rid of. And so that's the TH1 immune system. The TH2 immune system comes into play. It's late to the game. Comes late to the game when you've had a real infection. When you've had a real infection, a pathogen gets into your bloodstream, and in the presence of fever, at the end of that whole process where you actually have the infection, whether it's measles or strep throat or chickenpox or whatever, late to the game, the last thing that shows up are the B cells to make the antibody that you remember it by. So this whole concept from the beginning of injecting stuff to create antibodies, it doesn't work. It's based on a false premise. It just should not be happening. So the TH1 side of the equation, they discovered something called toll-like receptors, spelled TOLL-LIKE, so toll-like receptors. And so far, they first discovered them in fruit flies. And then they said, well, I wonder if they're in humans. And they discovered them in humans in about 2011. Which is when the discoverers of the 10 different types of toll-like receptors that we are aware of right now, there may be more, but we know that there are 10. They just got the Nobel Prize for medicine in like 2011. This is brand new science. And what they found with the toll-like receptors is that they are in every cell in your body, and they are the hypervigilant receptors that really differentiate between self and non-self. And they recognize foreign bacteria and foreign proteins that get into the bloodstream by pattern recognition. It's not an exact lock and key receptor site. They just go, wait a minute, that bacteria, that doesn't belong here. They whistle, which means that they send out cytokines and they go, hey, white blood cells, come over here and take care of that. That doesn't belong here. Get rid of it. Then so the toll-like receptors are like the cops getting rid of the stuff that doesn't belong there. And we get bacteria and by pattern recognition. Michael, when I first read that, it brought tears to my eyes of how beautiful that was, of what our maker gave us, what God gave us on the surface of all of our cells to keep us vigilant of things that don't belong in there all day long. And it happens, it goes on 24/7 from the time you're born. These toll-like receptors start to differentiate between self and non-self. And it's this beautiful thing. And we get bacteria in our blood all day long, from brushing our teeth, from having sex, from having a bowel movement, from little cuts that we get in our skin, from all of these, from the things that we eat that get into our gut. If we've got some disruption in our gut, we've got some leaky gut, it goes out into your bloodstream. All day long, we get viruses and bacteria into our body that our TH1 innate immune system, toll-like receptors, just take care of it without any notification going on at all. Then what really happens is if you get a really bad bug that gets in there, or you get a volume, a large number of bugs, that the TH1 receptors can't, or the toll-like receptors say, oh, well, that's a really big one. We need more than just to call over the white blood cells and eat those up. We need to really pull out all stops on this one. So they send out a whole bunch of cytokines, and a whole bunch of white blood cells go in there, and they start to generate a fever. And that's why fever is so important. And I've actually written even a little ebook on that, the importance of fever. So when the fever starts happening, those foreign pathogens can't live in that. And then a whole bunch of things happen. A whole bunch of white blood cells come, fever comes, you know, things happen. You vasodilate, you get hot, you do all those things that are important to fever. And so there's this battle that literally goes on, your immune system is fighting off those bad pathogens in the presence of fever. And so the fever, this is so important to have fever. And so we're trying to vaccinate so kids don't ever get fever. And they actually tell people to, when they go get a vaccine, to take some Tylenol so you don't get a fever. So in the presence of this infection, this whole infection of any type of pathogen is going on, as we start to win that war and we get rid of the stuff that doesn't belong there, the last thing that happens is the B cells from your TH2 pathway come along and glob onto that whole process and make an antibody that says, okay, I'll remember this whole battle in the presence of fever between TH1, TH2, pathogens, white blood cells, cytokines, all this stuff. I'll remember this. So if that same bad bug comes along again, we'll neutralize it before we have to go through this. So then you get these memory antibodies from a natural infection, and that is natural, normal herd immunity. So it's the presence in this dance of the TH1 and the TH2 system in the presence of fever that gives us true natural immunity. And that's why this whole concept of vaccination and trying to prevent a fever, a cough, and a rash and all this stuff is just a false premise that in the whole industry just needs to go away. So the whole idea of these exosomes, like I said, is relatively new science, only 30 years that they started reporting about this. The toll-like receptors has only been since, I don't know, 2000, maybe early 2000, so it's only like maybe 20 years old or less. 2011 is when they got the Nobel Prize. I mean, that's 9 years ago. It's brand new science that takes the entire injection of foreign matter into human beings to somehow keep them healthy and turns it on its head and makes it just go flush down the river. You know, I've long said that, you know, thoughts are things and words have power. Thoughts are things and words have power. So, you know, thoughts are things. I mean, if you pray for somebody or you say, I'll send you some energy. I mean, it's a thing. Thoughts are things, you know, and what you say resonates through your body that's 70% water. And so what you're saying really impacts your physical body. So if you say, you know, we have a lot of cancer in our family, I'm probably going to get cancer. You probably will, you know, at some point in time. And the law of attraction sort of draws that in too, you know, because the law of attraction works all the time, whether you believe in it or not. And I've said that, you know, someday, it won't be in my lifetime, probably not in your lifetime, not as long as the pharmakia are in charge of our world. You know, pharmakia is the Greek word, I think it's Greek, that means sorcerer. And it's the base word for pharmacy in the pharmaceutical industry. So it's all, as long as the sorcerers are still in charge of our world, this will never happen. That when you go to the doctor, if you have something wrong and you go see a physician or some sort of a healer, some sort of a medical person, the place to start is with those emotional hits. You know, what's going on with you emotionally? Why do you have anxiety? What's going on with you in your personal life, your relationship life, things with your children, your relationship with God? I mean, what's really happening on that emotional level? And then when you clear all that out and 90% of your symptoms go away if there's something that remains, it probably is something that's truly in your body. You know, something like maybe you need an osteopathic or a chiropractic adjustment. You need something realigned. Or there really is, you injured your muscle and you have a trigger point in it. And you need a little acupuncture to make that go away. I mean, there really, what's left after you get rid of all the emotional stuff and the body has ability to heal itself. Sometimes I think there still are some things in the body, but it's the minority thing. It's like the cleanup crew. It's like the last thing you take care of after you get rid of everything else, you know? And yeah. I've always said that should be what we should do. And what physicians should know. I mean, when you go to a lawyer, you expect them to know something about the law. If you go to see a CPA, you would expect them to know something about business and taxes. When you go see a physician, they are supposed to be an expert in anatomy, physiology, and biochemistry. And if they are an enlightened physician, they should know something about energy medicine, and they should know things about nutrition and lifestyle and diet. And they should know something about supplements, because we had to learn the Krebs cycle and all of that stuff from biochemistry for a reason. And so all of those things that, like magnesium and calcium and CoQ10 and all those supplements that we take that the medical doctor goes poo-poo about, it's like, well, you learned that in biochemistry. Remember? You kind of remember that? So we're supposed to be experts in that. But what the entire industry has become is just a pill pusher. It's all they do. It's symptom pill, algorithm-driven medicine that leads to a diagnosis for which I can prescribe a pill. So doctors don't, even though you went through anatomy, physiology, and biochemistry at least 3 times, you did it in high school, which made you interested in becoming a doctor. Then you did it in college because you needed that next level up of information to pass your medical school entrance exams. And then your first year of medical school is all anatomy, physiology, and biochemistry. And by that time, these smart young people are like, I'm so bored with this. I've already done it. Get me to the real stuff. Teach me surgery and pharmacology, because that's medicine. And it isn't. The money is in the medicine, not the cure.
Yeah,
the money is in
exactly.
The medicine. And that's why when you've listened to all of these, here in America, when every day when President Trump was having their press conferences with, you know, Birx and Fauci and all of these things every single day, they're all talking about therapeutics and vaccines. We have to have therapeutics and vaccines. It's like, well, no, we need to have vitamin C, vitamin A, vitamin D. And I think this focus on hand washing and hygiene has been a good thing. But because I think we are kind of lax about that, hand washing. But we've created an entire world of OCD hand washers. Obsessive hand washers now. We've created a new pathology, and we're telling everybody to use like hand sanitizers, which does nothing for viruses, you know? And so we've got this entire OCD world and masks. Oh my God, masks. Tell me, really. I mean, the mask that does nothing to keep me from spreading anything to you, and nothing from me from getting anything from you. And I read something about masks that they said that wearing a mask is like putting up a chain link fence around your garden to keep out mosquitoes. Dr. Russell Blaylock put out a really, really good paper a week or two ago about this. And he cited some studies in there that I was not aware of. I mean, there was a study that was done that they, you know, like all the surgeons that wear all these masks and all these different things in surgery. And apparently there was a study that was done on surgeons that did a surgery with masks, and they compared it to surgery that was done without masks. And there was no difference in infection rate, like none. So what that tells you is all that mask stuff that's happening does nothing at all. No difference in not having anything on. And they also did a study where they used pulse oximetry to test what the oxygen level was on the surgeons that were wearing masks through prolonged surgeries. And I think they used probably a pulse oximeter. There's ones that you can get that you can use on the earlobe. And so I think, and what they showed was that the oxygen levels went down by as much as 20%. And one of the side effects of that was causing headaches to where people had to take medications for them. They were that bad. And that some of the surgeons said that they didn't think real clearly in long surgeries. Well, that's kind of scary. If you're the patient, if you're kind of scary and the oxygen levels are going down on your surgeon, that he's not thinking real clear, and he's recirculating carbon dioxide, you know, that's your body's way of getting rid of the acidity in your body, right? That, you know, the acid goes into your lungs, turns into carbon dioxide, and you exhale it. That's a normal process of getting rid of acid. So you get lower oxygen, you get increased CO2 because you're recirculating it. the viruses and bacteria that normally live in your mouth that are normal symbiotic things there. Now you breathe them out into this mask that captures them, and you breathe them down into your lungs. So, you know, you've got an increased risk, you have an increased risk of contracting a different type of infection, that, you know, like a different type of pneumonia that has nothing to do with this pandemic virus thing, you know, and there's, and the other thing that happens is, you know, because you don't have a mask and you aren't having those facial recognition things, your oxytocin level goes down because, and that's your happy hormone. And so it makes you more depressed. I mean, there's just a whole cascade of things of why people have globbed onto this whole mask thing and how it's so important. And all you people who aren't wearing masks, you're just selfish because you're not protecting those weak people who need to be protected from these viruses and bacteria. Well, if you want to wear a mask, that's okay, but I'm not wearing it because I don't have anything to spread. You know, it's like the whole thing that they say, all these kids have to have a measles vaccine because if they're not vaccinated, they're spreading measles everywhere. Really? They're not sick. What makes you say that? And so they've done the same thing, the same psychological, it's a psyop, man. This entire thing, from the very beginning, for the first couple of weeks, Michael, I think was important to try to, you know, have people, because we didn't really know what this was. Was this really some sort of hyper souped up kind of pathogen that really was going to decimate society? Was it really chemical warfare? Were they going, look, it's a virus, but really it was chemicals that they were releasing? I mean, we really didn't know early on. So I think the first couple of weeks of hypervigilance and hypercaution was probably in order. But 90 days of it and months going on and on, now that we know the real stats, we know really what's happening. It's all economic. It's all political. It's all a way to usher in the new world order, complete control of us, this tracking stuff, these contact tracers, which is just a nice way of saying spying on people and spying on your neighbor and becoming a professional snitch for $30 an hour that they're paying here in the U.S. for when you get into that. And so all the people that have just lost all their jobs, they try to go back to work. They can't because the business now has closed because it went bankrupt. So they don't have any other options but to go work for the government and become a paid snitch. I mean, how dastardly is that? There's several different schools here in the U.S. that are training people to be contact tracers. The Johns Hopkins is doing one. The CDC is doing one. I think there's a Harvard one, and they're all done online. They're all online courses. So these have been planned a long time ago to be able to bring them all out right now. And the one from Johns Hopkins is the one I'm most familiar with. It's a free course. You sign up. You can go through the course for free. Millions of people have looked at it. The last time I looked was a couple weeks ago. There were more than 150,000 people who had already signed up for it. I bet it's probably triple or quadruple that amount now. You go through this training program, and that's like the preliminary training. And then if you want a certificate that says that, yes, you've taken this course, it's $49 to pay for the certificate. And then you can go get additional training from your local public health department because it varies from state to state, some of the rules. So if you're in, like I'm in Ohio, so Ohio's rules would vary from Colorado's rules, which would vary from, you know, New Mexico's rules. So you go to your local state department and you get a job and they're paying up to $30 an hour. It says it right on the websites. Now think about this. If you were in like the restaurant industry and maybe you were making, you know, $8 an hour plus tips, that $30 an hour to go be a snitch on your neighbor, it's a lot of money. And, you know, if you've been out of work for a while, it's like the great suck in. All these things that they're doing, I don't know what they're doing in the UK, but all the things that they're doing here about paying additional unemployment, it's a trap. It's a trap. So they get people all staying at home and all kind of cozy, and they've got all this unemployment money coming in, which is, you know, a lot of money for some people. Some people are even making more money staying home on unemployment than they made when they were working. And so now, and then it's the day's going to come. I don't know when that's going to be, 3 months from now, 6 months from now, but then the government's going to say, oops, we're out of money, no more unemployment. And then you try to go get a job, and the businesses and the industry that you were in have gone bankrupt because you refused to go back to work when you could have helped them out. And now there's nothing to go back to and no unemployment. Now it's a trap. Yeah. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And that's what they're reaching out for now, is absolute power over your mind, over your body, over this tracking of knowing where you are, of requiring you to be injected with a with foreign matter that could kill you, of microchipping you, of putting, you know, your tracking mechanism of how they're tracking people all over the world. I mean, this whole the most nefarious one, and I've looked at quite a few of these, but the most nefarious one I've seen is this one. It's called CoviPass, C-O-V-I-P-A-S-S. It's an international company. I mean, they've got offices all over the world already, and they've got everything all lined up ready to go so that you get the little microchip in your hand, and it can be scanned by any phone to tell you where you are. And they are already saying by 2021, which is only 6 months away, 2021 is only 6 months away, that you won't be able to buy, sell, trade. You won't be able to go to a public event. You won't be able to go to restaurants. You won't be able to go to the grocery store unless you've got your little microchip. And it can be scanned at the door to show that you've had your vaccine and you've been tested for coronavirus and you've had your swab tested and your blood tested and you've had your vaccine. And not only that vaccine, but all the rest of the vaccines. Because as soon as they get one mandatory vaccine through the door, it opens the floodgates for the 270 vaccines that are in the developmental pipeline and anything else that comes behind it. As soon as they get one through the door, the floodgates will open for them to deposit all of their dirty, filthy widgets into us, and we will have no say. We are fighting powers and principalities. We are fighting the dark forces of the heavens. This isn't just about Bill Gates and Tony Fauci. It's about who's driving them, who's behind them making them do these nefarious things.